From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Psychologist Judith Wallerstein just published the findings of her long-term study on the emotional aftereffects of divorce. On today's Fresh Air, she tells us that for parents and children, the wounds are deeper and more long-lasting than she ever expected. Also today, we talk with director Joseph Rubin. His 1987 thriller, The Stepfather, was a box office failure that's now well on its way to becoming a cult classic. Rubin's new movie, True Believer, teams James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. as lawyers trying to free a man wrongly accused of murder. And we have reviews of the new rock album from Elvis Costello and of the new movie, Cousins. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. We'd all like to believe that time heals all wounds, but a new study suggests that the pain of divorce lasts longer than a lot of families bargained on, longer than many experts predicted. And for the children of divorce, there are powerful and wholly unanticipated emotional aftershocks. These are the conclusions of my guest, psychologist Judith Wallerstein. She's just completed what she describes as the longest study tracking divorced families ever conducted. She began the study in 1971 when she interviewed 60 families who were going through divorce. She stayed in touch with the families, interviewing them 1, 5, 10, and 15 years after the divorce. She selected families from a fairly homogeneous population, mostly white, middle class, and suburban. These families were less likely to face poverty or racism, factors Wallerstein thought could obscure her focus on divorce. At the time of the divorce, the children were doing well at school and the parents were not in clinical treatment for psychiatric disorders. Most of the parents were college-educated. Wallerstein describes this as divorce under the best circumstances. Wallerstein analyzes the data from the first 10 years of her study in her new book, Second Chances. I wanted to know which findings surprised her the most.
Well, there were a whole lot of surprises in the study from beginning to end, and I think that's one of the advantages and one of the disadvantages of doing the only such study in terms of the length of time of following these youngsters and following them into young adulthood. What surprised me first was the vividness of memory and the greenness of the feelings that was attached to those memories. A youngster who has spent most of her life in a divorced family, the divorce occurred when she was 5, who at 20 says, "I remember my mother's pain. I remember the night my father left, her sitting up all night in the red rocking chair and crying and rocking, and my crying too." There were a whole lot of memories like that. The 22-year-old man who said, "I saw my dad beat up my mom. That's a scar I think of every day." I didn't expect to have so many of these feelings as feeling almost as if it was yesterday.
So the pain, the anger, the sense of betrayal lasts a lot longer than you expected it would.
Yes, especially since, as I said, for most of these youngsters, the divorce was more than half their life away. And yet these memories are enclosed. I was also surprised to find that a number of them were dreaming of scenes that they had seen when they were 4 years old.
Well, you found that 41% of the children who you first interviewed when they were young children are doing badly as adults. And I wonder if you think that that's because of the fact that their parents were divorced.
I don't think it's the divorce per se, and I think I think we're looking at a continuum, and I think it's important to bear this in mind, that we're looking at a failed marriage followed by the distress of the divorce, followed by a lot of stresses in the post-divorce family. Now, let me say that 45% of the children are doing very well, and for them, there was at least one adult, for most of them, who was very helpful, who was committed to them, either a mother or a father, who really gave priority to the relationship with the child, and the child felt very much protected in that relationship. Some of these youngsters who were doing well also had a grandparent who was very helpful. Others relied on siblings, but there was a sense that they weren't out there by themselves and alone. Whereas with the youngsters who were doing poorly, they were more likely to feel that they were taking on responsibility for their parents, or that they were taking on responsibilities that were beyond them. As one girl said, I paid for my parents' divorce, and I gave up my childhood for my parents' divorce. In the families where there were, where the children were doing poorly, there were more than one divorce. One half of the youngsters experienced a second divorce during that 10-year period. Mm. So you get a sense of the unreliability of relationships. As one boy said, I don't know what's the matter with my dad. He keeps marrying and divorcing and marrying and divorcing. And he just doesn't seem to be able to keep any kind of relationship. Well, this is very distressing. One quarter of the children experienced a severe drop economically, and in their home with the mother, whereas the father's home was maintained pretty much at the level that it had been, and they were very much aware of the kind of life that would have been theirs except for the divorce of their parents. And then there was the very serious issue of many of the youngsters not being able to go on to college with any kind of real help or support because child support ends at age 18. Mm-hmm. And very few, talk about surprises, very few fathers in this group, and these fathers were not poor people. They were professionals. They were physicians. They were attorneys. They were business executives. Very few of the fathers who could afford it, only one third of those who could afford it, to use the exact statistic, sent their children with support through college.
Was that because they were no longer close to their children? Did they have children from a second marriage that they felt closer to?
Some of them had children from a second marriage. Some of them didn't feel as close, but all of them were visiting their children. So we're dealing with a subjective feeling, with what I've called a blunting in the relationship between the father and the children, so that the child no longer symbolizes the sense of continuity of, you're going to go to the college that I went to. You're going to go and tell me whether the basketball is just where it was, and so on. The whole sense of the son and the daughter as representing the father in some way was blunted by the divorce, and the children suffered as a result of this.
A couple of minutes ago, you mentioned one of the children who you've interviewed over the years saying that they feel that they have paid all their lives the price of their parents' divorce. And you've described something as the overburdened child syndrome, where a child basically has to take care of the suffering parent after a divorce.
Yes, we're seeing that. We're seeing parents who really don't recover from the stress of the divorce experience, and where the child takes on the role of holding that parent together psychologically. It's sort of a role reversal, but it's more than a role reversal, because the child's presence is also to ward off the parent's loneliness, the parent's depression, the parent's very serious worries, and so on. So we have very young children taking on responsibility for maintaining the parent as a functioning person, which might well have been the role of the other adult within the marriage.
Something else that I think surprised you, which you've called the sleeper effect, that some of the children who seemed to be doing pretty good at the time of the divorce had the after effects really hit them years later.
This was true especially among the girls. Girls generally do very well in most divorced families. This has been true in my own work. This has been true in work done by other researchers throughout the country. And I was very surprised to find that girls who had been doing very well all through high school, had very close relationship with their mothers, and had been doing well in school, on the playground, in their family relationships, that when they came to confronting in a serious way issues of commitment, issues of an enduring relationship, issues of marriage, a real man-to-woman relationship for real at 19, 20, and 21, and so on, that they developed acute anxiety and fear of being betrayed. As one young woman said, if my boyfriend is 30 minutes late, I wonder whom he's with. Another said, I'm afraid to use the word love. Mm-hmm. You can hope for love, but you can't be sure to find it. And you have a real drop in adjustment at that point and a rise in anxiety as these young women suddenly confront, for the first time in a very serious way, obviously they've had boyfriends during their adolescence, but in a serious way are moving into what eventually becomes the formation of the new family. And obviously, at this point, all their anxieties about the mother-father relationship in their own family takes center stage.
My guest is Dr. Judith Wallerstein, and we're discussing her long-term study of families in which there's been a divorce. And she started the study in 1971 and continues to interview the members of the families, the adults and the children. Her findings are published in the new book, Second Chances. Let's look at your investigation of joint custody, which is really a pretty new phenomenon among families where there's been a divorce. So this is information that's just coming in, you know?
Yes.
And 25 of the couples that you've studied had some form of joint custody. One thing you found is that joint custody seems to work the worst when it's court-ruled, when it's not something that the parents decided to do, but when it's something that the court inflicted on the parents.
Well, inflicted is an interesting verb. The court wouldn't like it, but I agree with you. I really see this as two different family forms. I think when the couple voluntarily select joint custody out of their commitment to the child, and that's one family form, and another where the court, as an authority, comes in when the parents are fighting with each other and tells them this is the way it's going to be. It's sort of a King Solomon's kind of decision. And I think that's destructive for the child, and I think the children that we've seen have looked very poorly under that arrangement.
Why is that destructive for the child?
What's created is a no child's land or no man's land where the child feels welcome nowhere, that when the child leaves the mother's house to go to the father's house, the mother resents the child going. And then as the child goes back and forth, there is no greater comfort and no greater cooperation. The conflict continues, and the child really feels in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in a voluntary arrangement, the parents develop ways that encourage the child. The mother will call the father. As I describe in the chapter on joint custody in the book, the mother learns to call the father so she can prepare the child. And so she says, oh, your daddy's waiting for you, and he's going to take you to the zoo, or he's going to take you to this, or whatever. And today's the day you go. And these changeovers that are difficult for young children are eased by the sensitivity of parents who are interested and concerned that the child maintain a relationship with both parents, so that the child needs that kind of help, and that help is the opposite of than forthcoming when that child when that arrangement is imposed by the court.
In families where there's a voluntary joint custody, where the parents have initiated it, the child still has to go back and forth between two homes. It's two addresses, two phone numbers, sets of clothes in each house. In some instances, probably. Well, no, I guess that wouldn't be true. There'd be separate schools. But there are a lot of differences from one house to another. What seemed to make that situation more easy to handle, and what made it more difficult for a child to handle when they were constantly going back and forth?
Well, there's several issues. What makes it, what's imperative is that the parents have a commitment to making it work, and that they give priority to that, and given that, they're then willing to live with a certain amount of ambiguity. So each one doesn't try to impose his or her standard of what's right and what's wrong, whether white bread is a terrible thing or whatever. These issues don't founder on the big issues of religion. They founder on the small issues of sleep time and discipline.
Oh, and television.
And television, exactly, and toilet training and so on. So people have to be able to live with a certain amount of ambiguity. They have to be able not to intrude on each other's lives. And that comes out of a real commitment to the child and a recognizing that the child's relationship with both parents should be given priority. And we're seeing more and more of that as the society gets educated. What's also important is the flexibility of the child. And not everybody's flexible. Not everybody can do it. And you can only tell that, really, by watching what happens with the child and how that child is doing. And here again, you need parents who can be sensitive to how the child is adjusting and fine-tune the arrangement in accord with the child's needs.
Now, you found, too, that it seemed to be more difficult for a child when the duration of their stay at each of their parents' houses was shorter. So, in other words, the more transitions you had to make, the more difficult it was going to be.
Well, there's a certain staccato rhythm that became impossible. We found that children really needed a time to settle into the new home and time to kind of get into with routines and so on, and then a time to prepare to leave. And if it's all going back and forth like under strobe lights, it's too much.
I think you found, too, that the joint custody arrangements seemed to become more difficult when the child became a teenager, at the point when the parents became less central to the teenager's lives.
Exactly. At the point that you need one telephone and one set of peers, and at the point that you have a boyfriend or girlfriend, you sure should not be encouraged to give that up to go stay with your dad or your mom.
Now, what about visitation in those families where there isn't joint custody, but one of the parents has the child living with them and the other parent visits maybe once a week on the weekend or whatever the arrangement is?
Many of our children did very well, and one of the factors that was important in their doing well was whether they were able to maintain a relationship with both parents. And it's hard to maintain a relationship in a visiting relationship, and I think a lot of parents don't realize how difficult it is, but it's not related, and this was a very interesting finding, it's not related to the frequency of the visit or the pattern of the visit or the number of hours in the visit. It really has to do with the capacity of the father and the child to find common interest, for the father to take a real fatherly role and not to play playground director, as some of our parents called their role, and to take that role over the child's developing years, and to stay in touch with the different these different developmental stages. I found, incidentally, and this again was a surprise, is that during adolescence, the boys especially, but the girls too, really experienced a rising need for contact with the father and for a sustained relationship with the father. And the boys wanted a real encouragement from him when they were 16, 17, and 18 in saying, I think you can make it, and as you move away from young adolescence into taking the first steps towards independence and manhood. They wanted encouragement, and they wanted some sense of an independent relationship with the father. And they would frequently seek him out at that point. And many fathers didn't understand this rising need in their sons at that point and weren't as responsive as they might have been had they recognized the importance of this developmentally for the boy. In the girls, we saw it at a somewhat younger age, in early adolescence, when they would reach out to the fathers. And they wanted some acknowledgement from him that they were important, that they were nice, that they were a valued part of his life. And some of the fathers were quite taken aback. One little girl sent her diary to her father 1,000 miles away, and the man was baffled. He didn't realize what a huge compliment had been conveyed upon him.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the results of your study, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dr. Judith Wallerstein. We're discussing the findings that she's related in her new book, Second Chances, Men, Women, and Children, A Decade After Divorce. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Dr. Judith Wallerstein. In 1971, she began a study of 60 families that were going through divorce. She's followed their lives over the past 17 years, analyzing the long-term effects of divorce. This is the first study to track a group of divorced couples and their children over such a long period of time. Her findings have been published in the new book, Second Chances. And this is basically the analysis of the data after 10 years of study. This is an interesting observation. You think that the children of divorce share a more conservative morality than their parents?
Well, this is my finding, and they don't believe in open marriage. They have very strong feelings about infidelity. Some of them are still angry at their parents for infidelities during their marriage, 10, 15 years ago. I remember this 26-year-old man who said to me, someday I'll say to my dad, are you proud of what you've done with your life? His father was unfaithful throughout the marriage, but this is now 12 years since the divorce, and the boy or the young man is still harboring very angry feelings about this. So you're looking at youngsters who want marriage, who want an enduring relationship, who want commitment, and who want children, and interestingly, who speak about the importance of not divorcing, not only on their own behalf, but on behalf of their unborn children. I thought that was very moving, that they would project it into the future in terms of their unborn children. And as one boy said, I don't want any other child of mine to live through what I lived through.
But we don't really know yet, do we, whether the children of divorce have a higher or lower divorce rate than their parents' generation.
Oh, as a matter of fact, we do.
We do.
The demographics are not what these youngsters want. The demographics mm-hmm. show a higher divorce rate. And in fact, in my own study, of the 8 young women who married early, by early I mean 19, 20, 21, 7 of those divorced already during that 10-year period. So one of the problems that we're looking at is what these young people want is not necessarily what they're doing. I mean, they're very frightened of divorce, but some of them get into relationships in which the divorce becomes almost a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I guess nobody's really anxious to have a marriage that ends in divorce.
No. Yeah. But they're anxious not to be abandoned. Mm-hmm. They're anxious not to be hurt. And they get then involved in relationships which, if they feel they'll lose them and they'll be abandoned, aren't going to break their hearts.
Well, this leads to the question, based on your study, do you think that if a couple is having serious problems in their marriage and they have children, do you think that they should stay together for the sake of their children?
Well, about that, I think we have some good information. All of our studies that compare children who are in unhappy and conflict-ridden marriages with children from divorce show that children in divorce look better. And whatever problems we're seeing in divorced families are the ones that I'm trying to address, but I don't think it's good for a child to remain in for the parents to stay married for the child. I think that's an enormous burden for a child to feel. My mother and father remained unhappy because of me.
I guess that gets back to something you were saying before, too, that the negative effects on a child is not just the divorce, but the anger, the sense of betrayal between the two parents. And so if they're feeling this anger toward each other without a divorce, it's not going to make it any better for the child.
Exactly. And I think that's very important. I make that very clear in my book because I don't want to roll things back. I don't want to turn things against divorce. I think we're not doing divorce well. I don't think we're protecting our children economically. I don't think we're protecting them psychologically. And there's a lot of stress in that post-divorce family, which I think we can work on, which I think we can change.
Well, what is doing divorce well?
Doing divorce well is trying to maintain for the child the same economic and psychological protection that child would have enjoyed in the intact family to the extent that that's possible. That should be the goal. And that means that people don't have a hunting license to just try to shoot each other down during the years after divorce. It means that if it's important in a good, intact marriage to maintain a model of civility and kindness between the parents, and that remains doubly so in a divorced family because the child is already coming out of one marital failure. And you don't want the child to grow up with a vision in his or her head of a man and a woman who can never get along in any way. I don't mean they have to like each other. I don't even care if they forgive each other, but I think they have to deal with each other with a certain civility and kindness. And the other issue that's very important is the child has got to feel that relationships are reliable, that parent-child relationships hold, that a father will maintain his commitment to the child, that the mother will maintain her commitment, and so on. In other words, the child's need for a good family don't modify because that child's in a divorce or in an intact family. And the sense of commitment and responsibility and moral behavior on the part of the parents is as important in divorce as it is in marriage.
I'll tell you what surprised me the least in your book, and that is that the person who initiates the divorce usually fares better than the one who didn't want to get divorced. But you did find that 10 years after the divorce, half of the women you studied and two-thirds of the men feel that they don't have a better quality of life than they did before the divorce.
Well, I think that's true. I think we may have been overly optimistic in expecting that people would be able to reconstruct their lives, or they'd be able to find a new mate around the corner and so on. I think also we haven't prepared realistically in terms of women being able to get jobs that take them into a more interesting way of life, that a lot of the women were working at jobs in which they really felt they were in an intellectual dead end, that it was in no way appropriate to their talents. But the issue that of growing disparity within the couple over the 10-year period, so that one person really benefited enormously for the divorce, and the other person was more or less a little bit ahead and being out of a stressful relationship, but not really importantly ahead, I think is a very serious one in terms also of the issues of values. And do you think in terms of value for the whole family? Do you think only in terms of the individual? And how does one make these decisions?
One message that it would be easy to take away from your study is that if you're going to get divorced, chances are you'll be unhappier for a longer period of time, and so will your children, than you expected. Would that be the right message to take away?
No, I don't think so. I think one important message to take away is that the child needs support and help and guidance from a parent, not only at the time of the divorce, but that over the years that follow. And I think we have to change our orientation. I think, for example, it would be very important for a parent to have several discussions with a youngster during their adolescence or as they move into late adolescence and so on, to convey to that youngster openly and explicitly that what happened to me is different from what's going to happen to you, and your experience is separate and different. And I certainly hope that you have a very good relationship with a man or a very good relationship with a woman. I think the issue of children feeling that they're walking inevitably down the same alley that their parents walked can be addressed and should be addressed. I think it would change what parents bring to children, and I think that would clearly affect what happens to them.
Some people look at the number of divorces today and reach the conclusion that the family is falling apart, that the family is in real trouble. Do you reach that conclusion yourself?
I don't think the family's falling apart at all, and certainly all of the children in my study don't believe so. They really want a family, and they want a happy marriage for themselves and the and their children. So there's no evidence that the conclusion that anybody's drawing here is a cynical one or turning one's back on that at all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for sharing the results of your study and for analyzing it for us. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
My guest has been Dr. Judith Wallerstein. Her new book is Second Chances, Men, Women, and Children, A Decade After Divorce. And she's the founder and executive director of the Center for the Family in Transition in California. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I talk with Garrison Keillor about his life since leaving the weekly broadcasts of A Prairie Home Companion. He'll also read from some of his new stories. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Director Joseph Rubin went to prison to shoot the prison scenes for his new movie, True Believer. Coming up, Rubin tells us about directing James Woods and Robert Downey Jr., as well as The Prisoner's ex-cons and Hell's Angels cast as extras. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Spike, the new album from Elvis Costello, one of rock's most influential songwriters and performers. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest in a series of recent American movies adapted from French films. The film is Cousins, and it's based on the French hit Cousin Cousine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Leading anti-apartheid activists in South Africa today withdrew their support of Winnie Mandela. Both the Congress of South African Trade Unions and the United Democratic Front joined in accusing Mandela of complicity in the beating death of a 14-year-old boy. The anti-apartheid leaders called for Mandela's repudiation by the black community. An associate of Mrs. Mandela says the announcement came as a shock, but that she expects her friends to stand by her. About 170 black South African political detainees today ended their hunger strike at a prison outside Johannesburg. Anti-apartheid leaders said many of the detainees would soon be freed, and the jailed strikers claimed victory. Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu said after a meeting with the government's law and order minister that freedom would come in a couple of weeks for a substantial number of the estimated 1,000 political detainees. President Bush held another impromptu news conference today in which he called on the Soviet Union to refrain from interfering in Afghanistan's affairs and to support international efforts to rebuild the nation after the long years of occupation. Bush was also asked about the efforts to end the fighting in Central America. NPR's Jim Angle has more on that.
A Central American peace plan worked out this week by five leaders of the region calls for democratic reforms in Nicaragua, including elections in early 1990, in exchange for an end to the Contra rebels fighting against the Sandinista government. The president said today there were some positive aspects to the plan, but questioned whether Sandinista pledges could be believed, saying we must be wary. Promises have been made, he said, and promises have been broken. The Reagan administration always defended support for the Contras as a way to maintain pressure on the Sandinistas to move toward democracy. President Bush said he also supports the Contras and that they should not be left standing alone, twisting out there, as he put it. Current non-military aid to the Contras runs out at the end of March. Asked today if his support for the rebels includes more aid, Mr. Bush said it could mean that.
I have every intention of seeing that these people receive humanitarian support. And how that comes about, we'll just have to wait and see.
The president did not elaborate on whether he would seek such aid from Congress. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
Salvadoran guerrilla leaders today agreed to a meeting in Mexico City next week with representatives of 12 Salvadoran political parties. The two sides will discuss the guerrilla's offer to support an upcoming presidential election in their country, provided that date of the election is postponed. More from Tom Jelton in Mexico City.
The invitation to discuss the guerrilla election proposal came from a group in El Salvador that includes representatives of all the parties legally registered in the country, including the ruling Christian Democrats and the right-wing Arena Party. Guerrilla leaders here in Mexico said they were somewhat surprised by the offer, since high-ranking military and government officials in El Salvador have already said they are opposed to any change in the date of the Salvadoran election. Just 3 days ago, the Salvadoran Defense Minister, Eugenio Vives Casanova, warned that if the government accepts the guerrilla proposal, the armed forces will be obligated to intervene. But the political parties have shown interest in discussing the rebel proposal further. Hugo Barrera, presidential candidate of the conservative Popular Unity Party, said yesterday the proposal is still alive. The meeting with the guerrillas will take place here next Monday and Tuesday. The delegation from the Salvadoran parties has not yet been announced. Rebel officials say at least two of their five general commanders will be present. In Mexico City, I'm Tom Jelton.
Police in Lockerbie, Scotland, said today that a bomb that blew up a Pan Am jet last December was hidden in a radio cassette player. It's believed that the player may have been put on board the jet in Frankfurt. In that crash, 270 people were killed. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 7.5 points to close at 2311.43. Advances led declines 7-5 on volume of 178 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 6 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In pop music, singer-songwriters come and go, but Elvis Costello has endured. On his new album, Spike, Costello is backed by everyone from Paul McCartney to Chrissie Hynde to T-Bone Burnett and the Dirty Dozen Brass Band. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
You're a fine one, oh yes you are. You're a fine one, just like me. And we're friends now, oh, wouldn't you say? We've been friends now, oh, haven't we?
It's an undeniable truth that most pop artists do their best work early on in their careers and then fall back on themselves, creating variations on or simply repeating the early work that brought them acclaim. There's no higher compliment I can give Elvis Costello than to say that his career stands in vital opposition to this tendency. Spike, his 13th album, is as good as anything he's done, and it's a pretty thrilling example of a rock musician grown to maturity. Even his pure pop singles sound a little brainier than most, and here's one he's co-written with Paul McCartney.
Is it all in that pretty little head of yours? What goes on in that place in the dark? Well, I used to know a girl, and I could have sworn that her name was Veronica. Well, she used to have a carefree mind of her own and a delicate look in her eye. These days, I'm afraid she's not even sure if her name is Veronica.
That's Veronica, the first single from Spike. This album is the first that Elvis Costello has recorded for Warner Brothers Records after a decade spent as a cult artist at Columbia. What this means in the rock and roll biz is that Costello is probably at a commercial crossroads. Either he makes it at Warner Brothers or he may not make it anywhere. For as smart and prickly a fellow as Costello, this could have inspired a couple of different responses. He could have relented and written a series of cynical but catchy pop tunes, or he could have dug in his heels and made a perversely inaccessible record, drawing on his great talent for tangled melodies and inscrutable wordplay. But to his enormous credit, he hasn't done either of these things. On an album of 13 striking songs, two of them really stand out. The first is a bitter denunciation of England as overseen by Margaret Thatcher. It's called Tramp the Dirt Down.
When England was the heart of the world, Margaret was her madam. Future looked as bright and as clear as the black tarmac at her. Well, I hope that she sleeps well at night, isn't haunted by every tiny detail. When she held that lovely face in her hands, all she thought of was betrayal.
Over the past decade, Costello has written some of the most lucid and vehement of all political pop songs, including Oliver's Army, about the fascist National Front, and Shipbuilding, about the Falkland Islands invasion. But Tramp the Dirt Down is his most explicit song yet. The other amazing song on Spike is God's Comic. Throughout his career, Costello has always made known his fondness for English music hall tunes and for the pop songcraft of pre-rock composers like Cole Porter. On God's Comic, Costello shows himself capable of a musical complexity that's all the more enjoyable for being so clever and casual. In the space of the first two verses here, he tells the story in the voice of a broken-down old vaudeville comedian, whose act used to consist of dressing up like a priest. In the third verse, the comic dies and goes to heaven, and gets his first glimpse of both God and Andrew Lloyd Webber.
So there he was on a waterbed, drinking a cola of a mystery brand, reading an airport novelette, listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber's Requiem. He said before it had really begun, I prefer the one about my son. I've been wading through all of this unbelievable
junk and wondering if I should have given the world to the monkeys. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, and I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared.
Listening to Elvis Costello makes you aware of just how tiny a range of emotions and subject matter most rock and roll deals with. Next Wednesday, the Grammy Awards will be given out. Want an example of how dumb and irrelevant those awards are? A decade ago, Elvis Costello was nominated as Best New Artist for his exceptional debut album, My Aim Is True. He lost. He not only lost, he lost to A Taste of Honey, creators of the immortal Boogie Oogie Oogie. Costello didn't release an album last year, so he's not eligible for an award on Wednesday, but I'm giving him one now anyway. Most Valuable Player of the Decade.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
The Chalice of Tucker was a playing the piano like he was borrowing a dirty book. He put a hole in his big bottom lip and gave his very best little boy look. And it was a song with a topical verse, which I'm afraid he then proceeded to sing. Something about the mood it doomed love of the fish fingers singing.
This is Fresh Air. In the new film True Believer, James Woods stars as Eddie Dodd, a one-time civil liberties lawyer who now defends drug dealers. Robert Downey Jr. plays a young, idealistic lawyer who comes to work for Dodd and pricks the conscience of the graying, ponytailed attorney. True Believer was directed by my guest Joseph Rubin. Rubin got his start directing teen exploitation films like The Pom Pom Girls and went on to direct Dreamscape and the 1987 cult film The Stepfather. In this scene from True Believer, Robert Downey Jr. accuses his new boss of having abandoned his values.
I've helped acquit a coke dealer, a speed dealer.
I specialize, Roger.
An angel dust dealer.
I'm not a kid anymore.
Speed manufacturer.
So get a job on Wall Street. I'm sure your rich daddy can arrange it.
Look, man, don't tell me where to work. I came to New York to work for Edward Dodd, but I just can't believe that Edward Dodd has nothing better to do these days than invoke exalted legal issues to get off guilty little...
You want to be a criminal defense attorney? Then know this going in. Everybody's guilty. Everybody.
You know that you wouldn't have said that 10 years ago?
10 years is a long time.
Were James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. already cast when you took on the film?
No. In fact, at the first meeting with the producers, they asked me who did I see in the role of Eddie Dodd, and I said James Woods. And they sort of looked at each other, and I was thinking, oh, okay, that it was a nice try to get this job. And then they said, well, you know, we're thinking along the same lines. So Woods really became the first and only choice. Anyone else, I think, would have made the character too soft at the edges, too immediately likable. What we were going for with that character was a guy who, when you first meet him, you're not sure how you feel about him. And that gradually, as the movie goes on, you start to get behind him and start to root for him ultimately. We didn't want a puppy dog actor, and Woods is certainly not a puppy dog actor.
James Woods isn't the kind of actor that's a chameleon, where he's totally different and unrecognizable in each role. And there are certain, almost like James Woodsisms, that I find greatly enjoyable to watch. What does that pose for you as a director? What kind of questions does that raise for you as a director?
Well, when you hire Woods, you know you're going to get certain things. You're going to get a tremendous intelligence. That worked totally for this character. This is a lawyer, a brilliant lawyer in some ways. And, you know, you get a fire out of Woods. That's what you're getting when you hire him. And, you know, I mean, there are all different ways of working with Jimmy. You can't tell Jimmy, you can't give Jimmy direction like, be angrier, because then he'll blow the roof off. You've got to make real subtle adjustments with him. About 20% of the time between a take, I'd come up to him to give him some adjustment, and he'd go, I know, you want me to do da-da-da-da, and I go, yeah, that's exactly it. He's very aware as an actor. He's very savvy, so you got to talk to him straight, and you try to manipulate him and forget it, then you've lost him immediately. Because he's smarter than you are, and if you don't believe it, he'll tell you.
There are several prison scenes in the movie, and as I was watching the scenes, I was thinking about what interesting faces the actors had and how believable those faces were in the role.
Well, it's
in the roles of prisoners. And then, yeah, I read the press kit and found out, well, gosh, a lot of these people really are prisoners that you were using as extras, and there were also people, from the Hell's Angels and from halfway houses.
Right.
It must be kind of interesting as a director to be working with dozens of people who aren't really actors, but who are, in fact, pretty tough guys.
Oh, yeah. Well, the movie opens in prison, and we didn't want to do it on a sound stage with extras. We went to Folsom Prison outside San Francisco, which is the toughest prison in California. It's mostly lifers and long-term sentences. And the guys there are extremely tough, extremely dangerous. Before they would let us in, the administration, the prison administration, made us sign a no hostage release, meaning that we understood that if we were taken hostage, they would do no negotiating on our behalf, and that we were, in a sense, on our own. See, the movie really becomes, in a certain sense, about Eddie Dodd, the Jimmy Woods character, fighting to free an innocent man. And it was important to us that early in the movie, even though there's not much in prison, that what was there would quickly give a little sense of the hell of living in a world like that.
What kind of security did you have when you were shooting the prison scenes in prison with prisoners as extras?
We had guards, and they had guys on these gun rails with live ammunition. We were told if anything happened, don't run, because anyone running, in effect, they feel is running away from something and is guilty and is a target. The other thing they were afraid of was that some of the prisoners might slip in with the crew as we were leaving. So when we were finished shooting, they put us in this sort of big open pen and took 2 hours to count all the inmates in Folsom to make sure that they had the right count.
Well, there is a scene early on in the movie where someone actually does get knifed. I don't mean in real life, I mean in the movie.
Right.
So someone gets knifed and there's a little mini riot that breaks out.
Right.
Were you allowed to use prisoners as extras in that scene?
No, not that scene. I mean, that scene was too volatile and too violent. That's when we used the Hell's Angels and ex-cons and you know, people that looked right and felt right and understood that world a little bit.
The film that you did right before True Believer was called The Stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about a sociopath who wants to have the perfect family, the perfect family that he imagines everyone else has. So what he does is he marries widows with children, and when they disappoint him because they're not the perfect family, he kills them, creates a new identity, and finds another family to marry into. What spoke to you about that story?
Well, what interests me was that this guy clearly was a psychopath and an awful person, but in his dream of a home and a family, I found that sympathetic. So to me, that's always interesting when you have an awful character who has a very sympathetic drive. So that was the initial spark for me, and it also seemed an opportunity to kind of poke fun at kind of the image of what life should be like and rarely is. And I thought it could be funny and scary, and I like movies that shift tones quickly, where something horrifying happens and then something very funny happens right on top of it, because that's what interests me. I mean, to me, the funniest things happen at the most awful times, And I like movies that kind of try to do that thing.
The Stepfather never did well commercially, but it got some rave reviews, including from Pauline Kael. Mm-hmm. And it's really become something of a cult film. Why do you think the film did so poorly?
I would say two things. Marketing. It was a tough movie to market, and they never quite figured out how to do it. And secondly, I think for a mass audience, what it was sort of dealing with and saying may not be what they were particularly interested in hearing. It's funny because it actually did extremely well in video and did strong foreign to the point where they're doing a sequel. We beat up Jerry Blake, we shot him, we knifed him through the heart, but it turned out we didn't kill him at all. He's coming back. We should have done a better job of getting rid of him.
The distribution company for The Stepfather did different ad campaigns trying to advertise it as a thriller, as a slasher film, as a horror film. Was that interesting for you to watch and to see if the different ad campaigns registered a different response?
I wouldn't say interesting. I would say painful.
Mm-hmm.
They had it. It was very difficult. They really gave it their best shot, but they didn't know what to do with it. And it was only the critics that sort of saved it from oblivion.
So what was the moral for you of this experience?
Well, for me, it's really just a question of trying to make good movies. And from good movies, things happen so you can make other movies. And so in that sense, there was no moral. It got me some good scripts, and it ultimately got me a script that I loved and a movie that, I mean, True Believer is definitely the first movie that I made that I know I would have gone to see. The others, I don't know. I might never have seen The Stepfather or Dreamscape myself, so I can't blame the public. But True Believer, I would definitely, that kind of movie, kind of a movie with a good story and strong characters, that's the kind of movie I run out to see myself.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Great.
Joseph Rubin directed the new film True Believer, starring James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, what's coming up?
Hello, Terry. Well, we'll have a report on President Bush's news conference today. He held an impromptu talk with reporters at the White House, and he answered questions about, among other things, the Central American Agreement that was reached by presidents from the region, which would call for the dismantling and the disarming of the Contras. What do you have to say about that? Also, his comments on the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Hear anything from Afghanistan?
Yes, we have a report from Lise Doucette today about a rocket attack on the Afghan capital, on Kabul, on this the day right after the last Soviet troops left. And a story from here about what 9 years of Soviet fighting there did to the Afghans.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some people love foreign movies. Others won't go near them. Recently, Hollywood has been remaking some popular French movies with American casts and scripts. Last year, there was Three Men and a Baby. This year, we got Three Fugitives and now Cousins. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Cousins.
There's a certain kind of movie sequence that, frankly, I can't stand, no matter how good the picture surrounding it is. You know the kind I mean. Our hero and heroine meet cute. And then as they start falling for each other, it's time for the dreaded love montage. The couple go to the beach and eat hot dogs and laugh and jump on the Ferris wheel where it's really hilarious because they get stuck at the top and all along we never hear what they're saying because the whole sequence is nothing but little snippets of scenes with the movie's love theme playing over them. Well, it's finally here. The movie for all those people who wondered what they were really saying at the top of the Ferris wheel. Cousins is like one long love montage. Only slowed down so you can hear every blessed word. Come on, listen up.
If the lake were to swallow me up right now, I would die a happy man.
It has been a long time since I've been this happy, too.
Is it just me, or do you also have this uncontrollable desire to put our lips together?
We can't.
You're right.
Have you ever cheated on Tish?
Once. In Monopoly. I stole all her good properties while she was doing her nails.
That was Ted Danson and Isabella Rossellini as the two nicest, sweetest, most charming people in the world. Heck, these two will sleep together only as a last resort because they're so darn nice, especially compared to their spouses, Sean Young and William Peterson, respectively, who met at a recent wedding party and snuck off together to make it in Peterson's BMW. That's how Danson and Rossellini met, you see. They were both wondering what happened to their spouses. And now they really like each other, and we really like them. And the scenery up there in British Columbia is just terrific. And Joel Schumacher, the director, is better at soft focus than anyone since, well, since Jean-Charles Tachella, who made Cousin Cousine, the 1975 hit French movie on which this one is based. Now, Cousin Cousine was no prize, but it had some grace and some subtlety. And the way it spun its story through a kind of reluctant indirection was genuinely seductive. Cousins reduces all of that to two big questions. When are these two going to jump in the sack, and will they get away with it? And by the way, do we care about their spouses? Of course not. In the world of Cousins, there are only two kinds of people, amazingly wonderful people and amazingly crass people. And the crass people, who include the spouses in question, deserve what they get. What they get, however, is better acting than they deserve. William Peterson manages to humanize the insect-like car dealer he plays, and Sean Young is dazzlingly sexy and funny as Danson's unlikely wife. Meanwhile, Danson himself creates an astonishing screen enigma. We're told that his character can't afford a car, that he lives in a hovel in Chinatown and teaches ballroom dancing to modern maturity readers for a living. And yet Danson still manages to convey the impression that he's wearing a Rolex and has a closet full of Armani back at the old pied-à-terre. As for Rossellini, well, even in this infuriating movie, she's enormously winning. Can she act? Actually, she's getting better. And when a performer can sit on a screen and radiate the way she does, well, there are moments when you can forgive even the world's longest and sappiest love montage.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Composer and musician Wayne Horvitz has been one of the leading performers in New York's downtown experimental music scene, but he just moved to Seattle. On the next Fresh Air, Horvitz talks with us about his new record. Also, pianist William Balcom and singer Joan Morris join us to perform songs by Rodgers and Hart. And critic at large Laurie Stone remembers the first person who ever took her writing seriously. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton, Ed Doherty, and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.